And hello and welcome to the VFX show for another week. And we're going to be, I guess by popular demand, reviewing another TV show in real time. But let's first find our co-host, starting with you, John Flowers. How are you, John?
I'm really good, thanks.
Now, we have some independent films coming up in future weeks, but today, John, we're going to be doing a TV show, which should be fun. But before we get into that, let's talk to our other co-host, first time, Christian Martin. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
And now, you are the first time sort of co-host, but actually a producer of the VFX show, and so we're very glad to have you on in front of the microphone for a change. Thank you so much for all your hard work behind the scenes, and I hope you have fun in front of the mic this week.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Now, feel free to pull us up if we get our levels wrong or start doing weird and wonderful audio things, because I know it'll only make your life more difficult later.
I'll be sure and let you know.
So this week we're going to be covering the show Heroes, and we thought we'd just start with the first ep in of the first of the new series, Series 3, which is called The Second Coming. So if you're unfamiliar with the format, we've been doing it for a couple of weeks now. We're actually going to play the entire show down. We're going to be watching it here on our monitors, but with the sound down, and we encourage you to do the same thing. And then we're going to effectively do a narration. It's a bit like a DVD commentary for people that had nothing to do with the show. So we'll be discussing and effectively reviewing the show in real time as it plays down. Now, the show goes for about 43 minutes, and our show normally tries to go between about 45 minutes and an hour, so that seems to suit rather well. Of course, at various points in the show, it'll be jam-packed with effects, and at other points, there'll be suitable non-effects sequences. And in those non-effects sequences, we'll try and chat about some of the background of the show. So if you can keep in tuning along, we will not stop the show at any point, so we'll just keep it running. So if we seem to be rambling on, don't reach for the pause button. We're just filling in until the next big effect sequence comes. Does everybody have their version of The Second Coming in front of them?
Absolutely.
Indeed, I do.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, we'll start that. And when I say go, and then as I say, we'll keep it running until the end. And this is, in my case, watching it from the iTunes download of the show. And so the iTunes download, I say that because you can get this from several places, and some of them have commercials and things. We're not running with that. We're running with the commercial-free version, as in fact this show is in fact commercial free, much to John's amusement when I started having a rant about that the other day. Okay, guys, so we'll start in 3, 2, 1. So coming out of black, we have the volume 3 villains opening piece and the sort of now quite characteristic earth shot. And we should point out that most of the visual effects for this are done by Stargate Digital. Stargate Digital have been doing a bunch of visual effects for Heroes for some time, have a small, very dedicated crew, and I think have done an excellent job. We're starting out in the future. Any comments, guys, on are you fans of the show? Do you watch it regularly?
This is really my first time watching the show. I haven't followed it to this point, so definitely had no background as far as the first two seasons, or first season and a half, I guess, if you talk to some people.
So you must be incredibly confused by what's going on.
I had to watch it a couple times before I figured out where everything was going.
What about you, John?
I'm a huge fan of the show. I thought the first season of Heroes was probably some of the best stuff on TV.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was really, really good. So for regular viewers who were watching this for the first time, they'd be surprised to see what was one of the sort of hero-y popular nice characters taking aim at one of the other hero popular nice characters. And this was obviously the intended sort of shock value of being set in the future. And of course, a good visual device as well as a good plot device to get your attention as to how did this character come to be pointing a gun at this character and what's going to go on. And we're going to be treated in this episode to some new visual effects by nature of some having some new characters, or at least some actresses coming back, but as their twin sisters. A good soapbox device if I've ever heard one. But right now, we're going to do our first time jump and slow motion bullet effect. And I'm going to say that this seems to be a series that has an enormous amount of slow motion or frozen time type material in it. Judging not only from this episode, but actually the first three or four eps of the series, there are multiple characters that are able to freeze time and multiple characters that we see that are going to be playing with time. But that first shot with the bullet seemed to work pretty well. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think it's great. I'm also interested to notice this time with the sound turned down that a lot of the time travel effect is actually sound. a lot of it is not visual. But no, I thought the bullet was really good.
I did like how every time they track in the opening, you know, this chapter, Second Coming title, they've had some really good tracking sequences. That one then on the floor would have been kind of hard to do because there was almost nothing to track to. But
absolutely. It reminds me a little bit of Fringe. You know how Fringe has tried to do that as well?
Oh, yeah.
That kind of strange 3D.
Yeah. So
we've definitely seen that a lot, that whole tracked effect with the type. You see it in commercials and in a lot of episodic TV now.
It's funny you should mention that. I wrote an article once discussing supers as visual graffiti and how the audience had completely tuned out of reading them because they were just stuck on top and you just looked past them the way you look past a window pane when you're looking out the window. And I think that for very much of those reasons, people have tried to integrate text both in commercials and otherwise into the shot so they actually pay attention to them. Though I think here it's just a stylistic thing that's kind of fun. So we've seen the Brother Bertelli shot, and I think we should point out that in addition to the visual effects we're discussing this week, there's an absolutely cracking first unit special effects team that's used throughout Heroes, and they are responsible for a lot of the scarring as well as things like the squibs and shots on the chest and stuff that we've seen in that assassination attempt there. And there's no doubt about it that Heroes builds well from having good first unit stand-on visual effects. As we'll come to that as we discuss some of the time effects. The only way that they can pull off some of these frozen moment time effects is by having a terrific special effects unit on set, producing a lot of really good in-camera effects. Now, the thing about any show like this, and we touched on it with Battlestar Galactica, is that we are episodic television, and we got a chance to speak to the guys from Heroes. We spoke to them in the first series, we spoke to them again over this third series, and they have 10 days to turn around an ep. That's pretty remarkable, don't you think, John?
That's amazing. I mean, they even had 10 days for this episode, this first episode we're watching here.
Good call. The end sequence we'll come to with Tokyo, they wouldn't have been able to pull off in the standard episodic run. They took a lot longer with that one. But generally speaking, yeah, it's 10 days an ep. And that means from principal photography until they have to turn over the show.
I read that they're doing about 100 shots, 100 visual effect shots per show this season.
Yeah, and of course some visual effect shots are simple. Some are vastly more complicated than others. This one has a couple of real cracker complex shots, but there is going to be things such as rig removal and split screens, and these will come down as being visual effects shots. But you're right, between 80 and 100 is what I understand to be the case. And the team isn't that large on doing it either. But you do have the advantage of having a really well-rehearsed team in action. For example, in, say, the case of Heroes, every single member of the cast now pretty much has been life scanned. So they have 3D models of all the cast members. So while we say it's 10 days, it's built on that. And, for example, with the pyrotechnics, there's an enormous library of pyrotechnics and stuff built up that they can again draw on. So, yes, it's 10 days and I take nothing away from that, but it is built into a pipeline that has those assets available, has those things well thought out and well able to be accessed. So, but, you know, full credit to them. And they actually go with a smaller team rather than a larger team to pull it together because they've found that a smaller, dedicated team that includes the visual effects supervisor actually doing his own After Effects compositing at times is just a much better way of working than having a really big team and having to spend a lot of time on management. So just sort of generally in overview, Christian, how would you rate this episode? Did you find it to be, I mean, as an outsider, did you find it to be, did it pull you in? Was that visual effects engaging, or did you find it as confusing as all get out?
I thought the visual effects were great. The first time I watched it, I was a little confused with all the various characters, but once I sorted all that out, I was able to pay more attention to the shots, and I was drawn in. I was very entertained by it.
John, I believe in the States they played a prequel to this that kind of gave you the background on all the characters before this start of the season. Is that correct?
That's my understanding. I don't have cable, so I wasn't able to see that, and in iTunes it only showed what we're watching now.
Right, which seems to me to be something that would be fiercely confusing, both to watch it and almost not to watch it. I mean, the fact is that time sort of travel, generally speaking, is a heck of a plot problem because, you know, at any point it's just like, well, why don't I just go back and fix that? Why don't I just go back and change that? And as you start jumping around having characters meeting themselves, I always liked the fact that in some sci-fi, if you met yourself, the entire space-time continuum blew up. Here they quite happily chat with themselves and take themselves out to lunch, which is kind of fun. Now, we should point out that the character, Hiro, who is sitting in the chair at this point, used to actually work at ILM, and he's very visual effects savvy. He's a programmer, was actually, I think, on the cover of Time magazine at a very early age as being a an example of foreign children of foreigners being incredibly successful in the USA, as he was somewhat of a maths whiz, and he and a bunch of other children were singled out for their success in America, having come from parents from overseas. I think it was either Korea or Japan. I apologize if I got that wrong. But there was an interesting story in the original series of Heroes. Do you remember at the end they had the string sequence? He goes to the future and discovers in the loft apartment a whole lot of string, which he himself, had, in his future self, sorry, has rigged up to try and make head or tail of time travel. Do you remember that, John?
Absolutely. He was in, I think, Isaac's apartment in New York.
Isaac's apartment, exactly. And as a consequence of doing that, they needed to have himself interact with himself in the future, and that meant motion control. But motion control through a web of string. And one of my favorite stories is the fact that when they were trying to look for him for these next take, they found him over at the motion control desk offering to reprogram the motion control Milo rig to make it simpler to move it through the string, which I thought was a pretty nice story. So here's Sila attacking, and Christian, you must get that Sila's a bad guy by this point, right?
Oh, yes. And how?
And in fact, this whole series is called Villains, and I don't know that I fully appreciate yet where they're going with the plot, because speaking beyond this episode, it's, you know, we even get episodes with Sila as happy family father man, you know, cooking waffles for breakfast, which has confused the bajillicans out of me. But I have heard criticism, John, that people said that everybody now has pretty much died and been brought back to life, and it's getting a little hard to keep track of who's up and who's down and who's good and who's bad.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. I mean, I don't know if you saw the last episode of that media show, but I have an entire segment on basically just what the heck is going on in here with Heroes.
But, I guess the question to be asked is, if this show didn't have tons of visual effects, would it be working? Is it the visual effects and their hero powers the thing that's bringing the audience in, or is that just a supporting character and it's actually in a really engaging story? Do you want to comment on that, guys? Anyone want to speculate how this show would be without the depth of visual effects?
Well, I can say with certainty that the first season, I mean, the visual effects were certainly great. In some cases, you know, you could tell they were rushed. But the story in the first season was really compelling. I mean, it was interesting. The characters were well drawn. There was a lot going on. And I'm always a big fan of shows where, you know, seven or eight characters come together and connect, and they're all in their own ways. So I was really fascinated by the way that it was unfolding. However, you know, at this point, I'm sticking around a little bit for the visual effects, and a little bit just because I can't believe a show that I liked so much is having so many issues.
Yeah, it's a problem, isn't it? Like, how do you deal with the fact that the audience expects a lot of surprises, and yet when you get too many, you start to lose the believability of it? And also, I guess the other problem, which I've often discussed, is you need characters to be able to be in peril. So if somebody can't die, like she can't die, theoretically, there aren't that many situations you can put her in that causes that much peril, because, you know, anyone shoots her, hits her, thumps her, whatever, she's just going to come back to life. And similarly, with Silas' character, it seems a bit like, you know, it seems both improbable that simply a thin wooden door would stop him, but also it seems improbable that anyone would have any chance of defeating him any which way he does, just given how many powers he now has.
Yeah, he can move a truck, but this door made out of balsa wood with a tiny little chain on it is going to stop him. That's pretty
good. Yeah. Hey, it's a good excuse to pay a little homage to John Carpenter, though.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Also, can somebody explain to me how this girl who came across the Mexican border suddenly has such good command of English? Didn't we see her last season with, like, quite a lot of trouble in articulating English? She seems to be quite fluent this season. Did I miss a couple of episodes where she went to college?
That's her hidden power.
Okay.
She speaks English fluently in the third season. Actually, there's something worth pointing out, which is there's an entire second season which never aired. Right, there were only 11 episodes out of a projected 24, and so there's a huge amount of backstory and a huge amount of information that has not been conveyed. And so when I came into this, I sort of thought, wow, you know, there's a big, we took a big jump, right, from where we were to where we are now.
Now, why would they not publish those now? And why would they, you're saying they were shot and trashed?
No, they weren't shot, but there was a script, or at least an outline for a script, and there was a lot of, there were, as you know, season two was going to be a lot longer, and there was going to be a lot of backstory about the Shanti virus, which is the virus of basically the sister of the guy that we're looking at on screen right now.
Right.
And so there was a backstory on that, and then a lot more information about sort of a lot of the origins of the powers that these guys have.
Yeah.
In fact, online there are comic books, apparently, which I haven't bothered to go through, but there are comic books with a lot more backstory as well and a lot more information that sort of augments the information we saw in season two.
I think Heroes has been very effective in using back channels like the web, like Comic-Con, to build a fan base. And generally speaking, I think that it's been very successful in doing that. I did want to just discuss one thing but we just was happening on screen while you were talking, which was the eyes blackening. And there's been a number of questions. Certainly we've got a couple of posts here at the VFX show as to how do they do that. And we spoke to the guys at Stargate Digital and asked them that question. And they said that most of the time it's just done digitally. There are occasions when characters are going to be moving around a lot in super close-up that they'll put contacts in. But generally speaking, it's just digital tracking for both the black eyes of death and the white eyes of seeing into the future, which we'll see at the end of this episode. Certainly, if not in this episode, then the next one or two episodes. I think those eye techniques work really well. I think they look real. They always freak me out. I'm not really comfortable with eyes flipping back in the head like that. Though I think this season we see a bit more that the eyes have milked over. Then it's just the complete whites of the eyeballs rolling back in their heads. But do you think that's effective, Christian?
I don't remember seeing the white eyes in this episode, but I think it would be affected, yes.
Yeah. What about you, John?
Well, I don't remember which episode it is. I think it's the one where he's in the desert.
Yep.
And he drinks something and paint. It was not effective at all in that scene. I don't know what was wrong with it, but it just didn't work for me. It was, like you said, it was really milky, and it didn't have the same effect that it had in the first season when it happened to Isaac. When it happened to Isaac, it was just haunting. Like,
yeah,
this guy was channeling something.
And I think the reason for that is that in the desert scenes that are coming up, and I must admit, I thought that was at the end of this episode, but obviously not, you still get to see their eyes underneath the milkiness, if that makes sense. In Isaac's scenes, I'm pretty sure they went completely white. At least that was my memory of them. And I had it in my head that his eyes had rolled back in his head as opposed to just milking over his eyes that were there. Seeing their eyes from underneath the effect, I don't know, somehow makes it less spooky for me, less frightening.
Right. And the blackness looks to me, just to be clear, it looks like the same effect that was done in The X-Files. If you ever saw that show, you remember the blackness that would seep in and it would sort of turn their eyes black, and it was that kind of, it was like oil seeping into their eyes, and it feels very similar to what we're seeing here in Heroes.
Though I seem to remember in X-Files we saw that filling the eye as opposed to sort of, in Heroes, we tend to cut to it and the eyes have that effect or it doesn't. Though I think in the black, it kind of blacks up a bit. But certainly, I seem to remember in X-Files, it used to sort of ink in, didn't it?
Right,
yeah,
definitely
it
inked in. And if you look at the woman who now speaks perfect English, her eyes ink in just more quickly.
Right.
It definitely is an inky effect rather than just a blackening. To me, it looks that way.
We're about to have, I think, one of the most interesting effects, new effects that we've seen this season, which is coming up in 1 second. Absolutely. We've just taken the notes out of the safe, and we're about to lose the notes that we weren't meant to take out of the safe. which, you know, surprise, surprise. I must say, if the whole show was just with these two guys, I would enjoy the show. I think they're terrific.
Yeah, I could watch them definitely for the whole show.
Oh, wow, and I think that they just went right off the edge and got campy and silly this season. But
really?
Oh, yeah.
No, I thought it was interesting to throw the dynamic that we're going to see at the end. But let's have a look at this effect and just comment on it as it happens, I should say. So There goes chemistry class. And so what makes this, I guess, most interesting, if you look at his hands through the effect, there's a distortion of, even you can see it on his suit there, there's a distortion through the effect. I think the effect itself is pretty interesting, but I love what it's doing through the background behind it, because it's not just composited over the top, it's actually distorting the image underneath. And I love that he's moving in and through it and around it and behind it. So let's just discuss.
He pushes it to the side like it's a solid or an amorphous solid.
Yeah, it's great. We're going through it there.
It's interesting. In the commentary, they said that the papers and people's hair and everything the hair was starched and the papers were on stands to keep everything in place.
Yeah, it's they did in, I think, series one, he froze time for a little girl that was going to be hit by a truck. And the camera moved through the frozen time on that. And that was, I think, one of the first times I saw heroes doing massive frozen time sequences. And that had everything.
Oh, yeah,
everything
that was the toy truck, right? Where all the boxes and everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a massive build of placing things on rods, some CG elements in and some not. Now, in this particular case, they've done the same thing. There are wires, there are rods that have all been removed, and as well as some CG elements suspended to try and make it... really, you know, hang and work in. And I think it looks really good. I think it's really convincing. There is some stabilizing and recompositing people back in who didn't do it. But you see when it unfreezes there, there are a bunch of air cannons and fans and things that are going off to try and give the actors something to react to. They are actually blowing air on them and doing things. The whole office was rigged with air. And I think that's a good idea. I think, you know, nothing sells that frozen time stuff more than things suspended in the air. And I'm guessing it's in show two that we do that with the bank sequence as well, with the freezing of time during the heist. But I think, you know, in that case, it's a computer that's frozen in the air. But you just have to have stuff up, and I think, and people at sort of odd angles. But there was also, I think, a train occasion that they did in the first series where they froze time in a train and Hero met himself and walked down the train. You can't do that with the frozen time techniques that you use out of the Matrix, because that requires multiple cameras. And not only does it require multiple cameras, but you can't actually sort of move through it in the way that the camera tends to, like following a Hero as he walks through. So that's only going to be possible as a combination of practical and overlaid compositing. What did you guys think of the trail? And we sort of covered it really quickly, but I thought it was a cracker.
I really liked the sound of when he touches the wave.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I liked his movements through there too. I thought it was very convincing.
I think that it's got to be a hard thing to do. Of course, it probably helps if you have an understanding of visual effects, but most of these actors now must be relatively confident with visual effects. Nice little morph there. I guess a morph is about the easiest thing in the world to do these days, but...
I was going to say, I mean, this is definitely a nice morph. But I've noticed in this morph, it's really interesting because it's not just, you know, your standard go from one guy to the next. They actually, I don't know how they do it, but they make his shoulders are more muscular and less muscular depending on which one he is. Like in the future him, the face is actually drawn down more. He has more jowls.
I noticed that as well. He really looks thinner, doesn't he? He actually has definitely a more ripped kind of, or maybe malnourished, depending on your point of view, look. And the present day version just doesn't. He looks... I was wondering if that was just me, actually, but I'm glad you mentioned that. I definitely think that there must be something going on there, and I can't imagine, given the way that they've been doing this, it's not like you could have the actor go away like they did in the Tom Hanks Survivor film, Castaway, where they actually, you know, separated filming by 9 months to let the actor actually, you know, lose weight and tighten up. Yeah, so that's not going to happen. And here comes this, I think what we're going to see is this sort of huge biblical reference throughout this season, start of which... we're just getting the first taste of here. I don't know that Peter Petrelli and the whole God thing is totally working for me yet. I guess I have yet to identify, and they're trying to build it, but I've yet to identify the overall driving threat. There's obviously an end of the world scenario this season, but it hasn't been as well articulated. So at the moment, I'm a little confused as to everyone's objective. Everyone just seems to be moving through the series of weird and wonderful effects. But I guess, would you agree with that, John? It just seems to be less directed, I guess, as an overall plot arc.
Yeah, it's starting to reveal itself a little bit with the paintings and the future past sort of jumping back and forth. But yeah, in the last one, it was pretty clear from the beginning, save the cheerleader, then save the world. You know, and even if you didn't know, even if you had no idea what that meant or where it was going, you knew what the plot points were, right?
Yeah.
Save the cheerleader, save the world. And this season, it seems like there's the mantra is sort of, or mantra rather, is sort of, you know, there's a future that keeps getting altered and I keep doing things and it keeps getting altered worse and it's just really bad.
I think the problem is that I like it when the audience has a little bit more insight than the characters. So you go, no, 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 you have to go in, for crying out loud, go in, she's going to die, kind of thing. And
right.
This one, it feels like we're learning things the same time the characters are. So consequently, I feel in no position to, you know, urge them to do anything. I don't urge Peter here to shoot his brother again or not. I don't know whether that's the right thing to do. It's sort of, I don't have a clear enough agenda of even who's a baddie and a goodie. And I certainly find it slightly annoying when all the characters that you're rooting for and love and seem to be villains in the future and the villains from the present in the future are good guys, because you kind of, I like anyway, just having guys that are on, you know, I like this guy, I want him to win. I don't like this guy and hate the fact that he becomes an evil, sadistic bastard that kills people.
Right. Well, so,
there's definitely, it's not as black and white, and with the exception of Siler, I mean, you're not really sure who you should be rooting for as of yet.
With Siler later on, you're not sure.
Yeah, Siler within two or three eps is either dead, having spontaneously nuclear combusted, or just an all-round good guy who should be left alone to look after his son. But anyway, again, this is in sort of some of the plot problems. I wonder if that magnifying glass was a comp. Do you reckon that was? Did you see it on his shirt?
Yeah, it's like really interesting. It doesn't look natural enough to be an actual magnifying glass.
Here it comes
it just
back.
Looks a little weird.
Yeah, it does look pretty funky.
And yet, yeah.
I mean, it's good. It's hardcore. I mean, I think they're trying to give us, you know, the thing about heroes that I've noticed is when things start moving slow, they give you some weird offbeat visual to look at.
Yeah, nobody positioned that magnifying glass by accident in the foreground center frame.
Exactly.
Didn't look like anything was done by accident on this particular set. It's a lot to look at here.
Of course, one of the achievements of the film from a visual effects point of view is that the entire thing is shot in Los Angeles. No matter how much it's set in New York, present or future, it's all filmed in Los Angeles. And the digital backlot that Stargate Digital have done is probably one of the single greatest achievements, their ability to have characters from Texas to New York to Tokyo and all be shot in LA is a fairly remarkable feat. It doesn't feel like that to me. Obviously, shows in the past without the digital backlot used to really feel like that. You know, that doesn't look like Hawaii. They've just gone into the hills. You know, I think $6 Million Man, I used to always watch that and believe that he never left LA, and no matter where he was meant to go, because it just all looked like LA. Would you agree that the film has a more global feel than it's entitled to because of the advantage the digital backlot has provided, John?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And my understanding, I mean, obviously there's a second unit on this somewhere shooting something. I mean, I have a place in L.A., and it's basically in West Adams over by USC. And I think I've mentioned this before. They shot episode 10 of season 1 across the street from my house in L.A.
Right.
But the scene that they shot was a scene that was supposed to take place in New Orleans. And
oh,
so
yeah.
that house that's in New Orleans is literally a house across the street from my place in L.A.
Now, this is his characteristic brain extracting thing, and I know some fans have queried the fact that he's no longer eating their brains, just sticking his fingers above them, but while this may look like a vast visual effect, the line across is a visual effect, the line appearing across her forehead, but this whole incredibly gory, incredibly did they jump the taste shark sequence of her skull is actually a practical skull cap. What do we think of this sequence?
It's well, reminds me of Hannibal.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
So reminded me of Hannibal, but I didn't like it in Hannibal.
Yeah, exactly, and I didn't like it anymore here.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating to me. There's actually a point in here where he's drooling. That was a little disturbing. And then there's a point where she says, "Are you going to eat my brain or something?" And he just says, "Well, that's just gross." So apparently, rather than eating the brain now, he's just, like you said, Mike, pulling out some piece of it that gives him power.
Well, in fact, it goes worse than that. In terms of its own mythology. Here he goes. He's just extracting it by stroking it, which is just bugging the heck out of me.
He pulls it out here in a second.
Does he?
I think so.
Was probably looking away at this point.
I seem to remember a sound that was kind of indicative of something being pulled out.
Right.
In a later episode, Peter Petrelli will take powers from Siler without actually cutting his head open.
Here we go. Just, he pulls it.
But is he pulling it out, or is he just sticking his finger near it and osmosisizing it out? And do I care? Is this shown during a time that people are eating?
Thankfully,
well,
no.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's weird, though, right? Because, like you said, it's absolutely a fact that in the past we were led to believe that this guy was devouring some portion of their brain, and I believe that they even said out loud that he had consumed some part of their brain, or there was some brain missing or something.
Yeah. There's a nice little reverse. Nothing like playing stuff backwards, is there? I think that's how they did that. I'm speculating now. That's how I would do it. I would. And there's the skull cap. Just so chunky. I wonder whether or not you just have to keep raising the gross bar, or at some point. Do you know what I mean? Like, you don't. I don't know. You really needed that. Or if we hadn't seen it, whether people would have felt like they were ripped off that they didn't see inside a skull.
I don't know. I could have done without it.
Yeah. I think there is a precedence for it. When she had her chest completely cut open on an autopsy table in an earlier episode, I felt the same level of, wow, do we need that level of chunkiness? I like to refer to it as the spare rib episode. I don't know if you remember that one, John.
I absolutely do. Yeah, the color in that was... I actually referred to it in a previous VFX show because I thought the color was so completely off. It just did not look like blood. It looked like... some spare ribs with some sauce on them. It was pretty intense.
So interestingly, we're 30 minutes into the show. We have like about 10 or 12 minutes to go. So we should at this point be finishing the second act and be propelling ourselves into the third act of the show. Though I wonder if a three-act structure is appropriate for an episodic television program, given the commercial breaks tend to dictate a different structure for on-air. There's almost sort of five sections to a TV show these days.
And I guess technically this is half of an episode, because didn't they air the first two together?
I think, though, that a 43-minute ep is an ep, if you know what I mean, by the time you add in commercials. So,
yeah, I agree. I have a weird sort of practical question. I've noticed every time we see the hero character, I see green or sort of fluorescent-looking HMI, whatever, lights, square lights in the background reflecting in his glasses.
Oh, really? I'll have to check that out.
And I'm wondering if that's something that I've just started noticing, and it's really bugging me. And I'm also wondering, is that something that you would suggest that people take out of a television show? Because does it take you out of the moment? I mean, it makes me feel like he's standing beneath a bunch of lights.
I'll have to check it out. In an office, it doesn't bother me because you just get fluorescent panels, and that's what would happen. I guess for me, one of the things I was about to comment on, which is a similar kind of craft point, was how much, not in this particular shot we're looking at now, but in the shots that preceded it, how much they go to great trouble to position out-of-focus foreground elements. We're often doing a pan left or right. We're starting to pan left or track left now, but quite often they'll do that with a foreground element way out of focus. I mean, they love a shallow depth of focus on this show, and it makes it look filmic. This season, though, I think it's been a little darker in that a lot of stuff has been these dark interior shots, which, you know, by time of day we're assuming is happening at the same time that everything else is going on. So it's the middle of the day. This is a very dark set, even if it and then to light characters that have darker skin on a darker set like this, actually it's quite a hard lighting challenge to get nice qualities of light on them. See, it looks like dark outside, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's meant to be a different time of day. But you see, there's the out of focus foreground test tubey stuff. They just love sticking out of focus stuff in front of actors. And, well, or out of focus actors in front of actors. There we go again. There's just a lot of dimension to the shots. They're always placing stuff and multiplaning that effect. What do you think of the cinematography generally?
I think technically, isn't that called shooting dirty from a director of photography standpoint, where you dirty up the frame or shoot it dirty? When you take an actor or an object and put it in the foreground and just blur, you know, defocus the heck out of it and then have the guy in the background in focus?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that term. That sounds right, though. I mean, that would be what would be a good way to. We shall from now on refer to this as shooting dirty, and if it isn't now in the lexicon, it will be within seconds.
Nice. I think the cinematography in this is just staggering. I'm constantly blown away by just how great everything looks, and you know, they rack focus like crazy. I mean, if you keep an eye on it, you know, they rack between three or four different elements in sometimes in a single shot.
Yeah, it's interesting. These two shots are technically easy to pull off, but they pull off some really interesting three shots and a three-way dialogue not crossing the line. I mean, it's fairly simple to not cross the line when you've got two characters. You stay on one side of them both, and just as we see here, you know, Peter's always on frame right, and he's always on frame right, even if he is out of focus, back of his head, there he's again, front of his face, frame right. But when you have three characters, and sometimes four, try not to cross the line then. It's actually quite confusing. And if you watch the cinematography on some of the office scenes when they have multiple characters interacting, it is actually very well technically executed. And I don't think, personally, I'm really faulting the cinematography. I think they've gone, as I say, darker, but that's probably a creative decision, given the title of the series is Villains. But yeah, really nice shallow depth of field, and as you say, that dirting up of the frame, which has got to take time. And again, the reason I mention this is we're talking about episodic television, which is on a very tight shooting schedule. There's another good pull focus for you.
I really like the darkness, too.
I think the cinematography is very effective, too. As far as episodic TV goes, they must be on an incredibly tight schedule, and it seems like everything's just really well thought out.
Yeah, there's no lack of clarity in terms of the filmmaking. There's no lack of clarity, I think, in terms of the visual effects. Any lack of clarity is only plot-driven. It's very clear what's going on. I don't find it confusing. I don't find it shaky. Camera's nearly always moving, but they don't go to great lengths to confuse you as to whose point of view we're looking at and what's going on. And here's one of those twin-sister reveals that I was referring to earlier, or I should say triplet reveals.
Yeah, something.
Yes, something, exactly right. There's also a couple of occasions we've seen this episode of screen graphics, so both news reports, in the lab, what we're seeing under the microscope and that kind of stuff. And I think they're all good. I think they do a good job in producing. I'm often critical of people that do news reports. They always look super fake to me, nothing like a real news report. And apparently that was a real scorpion, though perhaps not venomous. I don't know. I don't know much about scorpions. I'm not an American.
They did something with its stinger so that it wouldn't it wouldn't bother him.
Here's something in terms of cinematography. This effect when they're disorientated or they're trying to read minds, where they jump cut.
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Sorry, you're going to say, John?
No, I'm sorry. I was going to ask you about that. It's really interesting how they do it.
Yeah, I like it. It's and also flash frames of white. Now, this is important because this is now the build-up to what is the largest visual effects sequence in the show. Everything we're seeing behind the actors now, apart from these extras, is fully digital set, all done on a soundstage against green screen. They have no Tokyo plates. It's a fully digital set and will remain thus through the devastation that's about to follow. The only practical elements that will go into this whole sequence are a couple of sparks and flashes from the stock library when they're doing the destruction of this entire environment.
Right.
So what do
that
we think
pink
of Tokyo?
Tree in the background is real, though, right?
The immediate stuff around the set, the lamps, the where you see the extras walking, that's a local build. When you look back down the street, which we're starting to do in my case now, people are running forward. We've got out-of-focus stuff happening behind and neon signs. All of that background is digital. Somebody actually sent us an email also at the VFX show asking us whether or not the fire on the hands both by the mother and some of this electricity here, whether all of that is being done in max or whatever. Oh, slowdown, by the way. Do you see that slowdown? Looked like it was a post-slowdown without enough frames to pull it as he stepped forward. But anyway, the fire on the hands is all practical comped on. So for the person, I've forgotten their name, who wrote in asking us whether or not that was a CG fire when the mother of Claire has flames on her hands, that's all practical. And this is the big effect sequence here that I was alluding to. So detailed destruction, a lot of interaction, a couple of sparks and stuff, and of course the car, everything here is digital, as is the back plate we're seeing now. What do we think, guys? Starting with you, John.
I think that you saw a tremendous amount of green spilling into Hero's hair when he closed his eyes and, you know, went back to the past. It was, I think the background and everything looked fantastic. Although the spark effects were a little, I don't know, canned almost. By the way, you see the light in his glasses there that I was talking about?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
It's just brutal.
Christian,
did you see
think
the green
the
spill, by the way?
What did you think of the explosion? Did you agree with John on them?
I thought that it was pretty effective. I didn't really watch for the green spill. I'm sure if I looked more closely, that might bother me. But overall, I thought it was a really great shot.
I guess for me, what was interesting is to compare this to the New York destruction from Series 1. Now, the New York destruction from Series 1 was, I think, less successful than that one. It involved a lot more just a dust storm covering what looked to me remarkably like miniatures. Whereas
here's that effect again.
Yeah, here's that jump-cutting, cinematography, flashy, no actual visual effects required. Do you want to compare and contrast that New York destruction from Series 1 with that destruction of Tokyo, John?
Oh, I thought the New York destruction looked better. It looked
grittier. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It had more grit and grime
No way. I completely disagree. I thought this one was far more interactive and also just the toppling of the buildings. Really, it's really interesting you say that. I was surprised. I didn't expect you to go that way. So what did you think?
Are there any places other than Tokyo and New York that get destroyed in visual effect shots?
Yeah, no one ever blows up L.A., really. Have you noticed that? It's very curious.
You tend to lose L.A. into the ocean occasionally. You know, the odd... Sydney's only been destroyed on screen once, I believe, and that was in a B-roll shot in one of the Armageddon films. I think it was Independence Day, where we had a shot of Sydney Opera House tanked.
Yeah.
But apart from
yes.
that, we got off pretty lightly. But yeah, you lose L.A. into the water. But seriously, what made that one work in New York work better for you than Tokyo?
Well, the Tokyo one looked too digital to me. It looked too the New York one to me looked a lot more like it was a lot of elements sort of composited together, and then a lot of grain and a lot of actually sort of the way you would expect an explosion to look, where the Tokyo version looked like the way that you would expect an explosion to look if it were generated by computers.
Well, in fact, that was that was interesting that you called that. It was pretty much the case that there was more compositing on the New York one. The compositing now is pretty much done in After Effects, from what I can understand. There's a flame sequence, again, all done with compositing.
Yeah, why did they choose blue? That's the only thing I'm going to ask. What in the hell were they thinking?
Is it because nice time now? See, that's a really good use of slowdown of time.
Yeah.
Proper ramping of time versus the one on the stair approaching Hero, where it was, for me, felt like they'd step printed it. There's some really interesting ramping going on, but when it works really well, it works phenomenally well. Sorry, what was your question, John? I interrupted you.
I was just saying, why in the hell did they choose the blue with the white center for the flame for this guy and not something? I mean, I would have preferred green, anything, frankly, over this weird, like, day-glow neon blue, like, cyan or whatever cyan kind of color that they chose for the flame. It just looks so fake to me.
Yeah, I'm not really a favorite of the blue. I think the flames that... There's another ramping. The Claire's mother's flames, which are natural, look terrific. I mean, they really look terrific.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
But the blue ones, I'm sure, were just to give it some point of difference, I'm guessing now. A nice wipe device with foreground defocused element.
Yeah. While we're talking about just sort of practical things, have you been able to figure out why, when Hiro is speaking in Japanese, why the subtitles are all over the screen? Is it some kind of comic effect that they're trying to go for?
Yeah, they were trying to have, in the commentary, they were talking about how it's more like kind of a bubble, like in a comic. So they have it in front of whichever character is speaking at the time. And you didn't find that effective? Or?
No, it just looks silly.
It doesn't bother me, I must say. But then I just find him on screen to be one of the more appealing aspects of the show. Because some of the characters, I get to a point where I just want to shake them, right? Like, just, you're so whiny.
Yeah, well, like Mohinder here, it's like they took the one sort of rational character and they just turned him into, I don't know what yet. I referred to him as Brundlefly in my other show.
To Be Continued has just flashed up, as is their trademark. And we're into the end credit roll, which I think, I don't know if what's like for you guys in Australia, this gets compressed down while they put a trailer for another show above it. So in other words, if you were trying to even look at this, you'd have no chance in heck because it's compressed to be vertically about 18 pixels high at the bottom of the screen while above it comes
18
on,
pixels on a good day.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do the same thing here.
I don't know. I always watch it through iTunes, so...
So Mark Spatney was the visual effects producer from Stargate Digital. Eric was the visual effects supervisor, and that's a really well worked team. And they have, of course, end credits there if you could actually see them. Interestingly, the show actually identifies who they got commercial considerations from for product placements, which I think is remarkable because there was only three. And I know that. I think the all-time record is set by American Idol or Survivor, like 123 product placements. But, all in all, I think the show is, from a visual effects point of view, I actually reckon remarkably good. I mean, remarkably good. There's just no doubt on an episodic time frame, compositing and After Effects, with the amount of 3D that they've got to work with, even with a library of effects, week in, week out, delivering that kind of quality is extraordinary. They're currently up at about episode 15 in, and, you know, obviously they try and get ahead a little. So some of those effects, as we said earlier, the ones such as Tokyo, were only possible because they had pre-warning of them and they could build out. But still, even by the end of the show, they're going pretty darn well. And it's not like the end of the show normally comes without some kind of climactic finish that requires a ton of visual effects. We've discussed the cinematography as well. Christian, do you want to discuss the audio? You touched on it briefly before, but given that you're such an expert in audio, I'd be interested in your point of view on the audio.
I thought it was very effective. I liked that, and I liked the music. And again, my favorite sequence being the wave with the speedster. I just thought that was really, really effective in selling it for me.
Would we say that was the most successful sequence, John?
Oh, yeah, that was definitely the most impressive. I mean, it was visually new, it was gratifying, it had all the right elements to be something totally intriguing. I even like how when Hiro catches up to the super fast girl, there's a, you know, we take a little bit of time and then suddenly the trail, of course, you know, is retracted or collapsed back into her while he's walking around. So it has a really nice sort of tactile nature to it. And I believe I'm correct in saying that, I can't pronounce her last name, but Wendy Melvoin? And Lisa Coleman?
Yes, it's Wendy and Lisa from Prince, from Prince's
Band. It's funny, but I never know how to pronounce her last name, but they do the score, right, for Heroes?
Indeed they do, yes.
Yeah, so they're, of course, they're just, like, ridiculously talented.
Yeah, I think, I just did not know that was the case, that they were from Prince's Band. That was, where'd you find that out? You've done some good research. And speaking of which,
it's all on IMDb, man.
Speaking of which, Christian, would you like to thank our researchers for this week?
Indeed, I would. I'd like to thank Lori Apthorpe, and I'd also like to thank my friend Jandro Kirkish, who reviews the shows before they go out, and Kevin Hansen, who has done some great research for us in the past.
And John, we're going to go indie film, as I alluded to earlier. A pick from you, in fact, as to the next film we're going to review. Do you want us to give us a sneak peek on what's coming up on the VFX show?
No way. We're going to do Night Watch and Day Watch?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm so excited. So Night Watch and Day Watch are two films created by Timur, I cannot pronounce his Russian last name. I will, Nambetov or something like that. I will have it in my mouth and able to pronounce when we do it, the show. But he did two films, Night Watch and Day Watch, and they were shot for $1.2 million and 4 point something million. Really low budget, I mean, in the grand scheme of things. Really good stuff. He got his start with Roger Corman. A lot of people don't know that. And I'm looking forward to those shows.
Now, Night Watch was released in 2006. Actually, was it 2005? I think it was 2005, not 2006. But anyway, it is, in fact, available on both Night Watch and Day Watch are available on the iTunes store if you want to download the films. If you haven't seen them, they are, I guess, less common than some of the other films we've seen. But I am going into them with an open mind based on John's recommendation and other emails that we've received at the VFX show asking us to look at Night Watch and discuss the low-budget visual effects because, let's face it, a thousand-year-old truce between the forces of light and dark are always good for a fodder for a movie. Presumably... Actually, they are. They are available both in HD and in standard def. So if you wanted to rent them on HD on your Apple TV, you'd be able to do that if you wanted to watch them high res, which should be something that I think I might be doing just to really poke around at the visual effects because there's nothing like HD to really open up the wounds on visual effects as you can step through the darn things frame by frame. John, where can people find you moving forward?
Yeah, they should go to lifezero.org. I tend to collect the myriad of things that I'm working on there. I recently posted a article on how to build a RAID, a really fast RAID Zero system for under $2,000 US.
Yeah, that was a good article. Quite long, too, and detailed.
Thank you.
That was an excellent article, John.
Oh, thank you again. Yeah. I got linked to from a lot of places. I was really surprised. So.
Yeah. And Christian, you're actually working as a producer and doing other things. Are you on Twitter?
I'm not on Twitter yet. I'm teaching Audio 101 again at FXPhD. It's Intro to Digital Audio Post. And the term's just starting this week, if I'm not mistaken.
It is starting this week. And you'll find me over at FX Guide and FXPhD. This week's FX Guide TV, which is about to go up, which will be up by the time you hear this, is an interview I did with John Knoll from ILM, famous for, of course, not only his work at ILM and Academy Award-winning stuff such as Pirates, but also for inventing Photoshop. And we actually had a long chat with him about his early days and his pet projects outside of the traditional areas of visual effects, which I must admit was one of the reasons we did the series, so we could talk to some of these legends without just talking about their latest film, which is always fun, but still, you know, somewhat limiting. So check out that at fxguide.com, and if you go up to the top to podcasts, you'll see the FX Guide TV, where those are hosted by Angie Richards. Well, that's it for the VFX show. We want to thank everyone for listening, as always. We really do take your points on board, as I said, like stuff about this episode, stuff about the next film that we're reviewing, questions. We try and take all of your points of view. You can either email us directly, or you can, in fact, go to pixelcore.tv. That's pixelcorps.tv. And there's a VFX show place that you can stick up questions and queries and make comments and tell us that we don't know what we're talking about, and we always read that. Until next time, thank you so much, John.
Absolutely, pleasure.
And Christian, good luck editing it.
Oh, thanks.
See you guys.